All right, we're underway. Session 36, lesson 6, page 43 in your outline. All right, last week, the Pharisees complained to Jesus and his disciples, why do your disciples eat with unwashed hands? And that led into a discussion of why the Mishnah has a greater authority in the rabbinic mind than the Bible. And we looked at Maaseh Sanhedrin 88b, where the Mishnah states there is greater stringency in respect to the teachings of the scribes than in respect to the Torah. And the reason behind this lies in the fact that the teachings of the scribes, or the traditions, or the Mishnah, the oral law, is considered a fence around the law. The law is pictured as a park, and you don't want to get into the park and walk in the grass, you know, kind of mess the park up. So how are you going to stop people from getting into the park and walking in the grass? You're going to build a fence around it so they can't get into the park. And that became the focus of the rabbis. Don't break through the fence, no matter whatever you do. And so the focus now goes onto the fence rather than on the garden that the fence is protecting. Don't break through the fence. There's more stringency in respect to the teachings of the scribes. And the idea here is if we don't break through the fence, then we won't offend God, and we won't break the Torah, and we won't get sent into another exile. That's the idea. But of course, the attention now gets misplaced. It's all on the Mishnah. It's all on the traditions. And they receive then inordinate authority. And then we talked about examples of how this authority was expressed. And one of the examples we came across was the idea of tefillin. And everybody started bugging me about, well, what do all those wraps mean? Why do the Jewish people wrap their arms that way and all that? So that's why that handout came, all right? And so if you'll look at your handout, we'll go through the tradition here of the meaning of laying tefillin. Of course, here on the overhead, you can see the arm tefillin here. Now, what I did is I went to my handy Jewish book of Y to find the answer. And so I'm recommending this as a resource for you. This book was written by Rabbi Alfred J. Kolach. He's a conservative rabbi, so he's writing from a conservative perspective. You know, two Jews, three opinions, right? So you have the Reform opinion, you have the Orthodox opinion, you've got the conservative opinion in the middle. So anyway, he wrote this book because so many Jewish people came to him and said, why do we do these things? You know? So he got tired of answering them. So he said, I'm going to write a book and answer all the questions. So he wrote the first Jewish book of Y. And by the way, published it himself. Jonathan David published, publishers named after his sons, Jonathan and David. It was a hit. It was a bestseller. So he was then decided to write the sequel, the second Jewish book of Y. So it is now a two-volume series. And it's a nice little resource if you want to get answers like this. So if you're interested in Jewish studies, I would recommend you getting the first and second Jewish book of Y by Rabbi Kolach. Answers the question. So out of the Jewish book of Y, page 109, dealing with the hand tefillah. The hand tefillah is wound around the arm seven times because there are seven Hebrew words in the verse in the Psalms, thou openest thy hand and satisfies every living creature. And that's, of course, in Hebrew, because if you count the words there in English, you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. These are the Hebrew words. And, of course, he's referring to those wraps right there, the seven wraps around the arm. Now, as we go on, after being wound around the arm, the end of the strap is wound around the ring finger and the middle, forming the Hebrew word Shaddai, meaning God. And so he's talking about the wraps there. So those are the meanings of the wrappings. In addition, the winding of the strap three times is also done because Hosea, in chapter 2:21 and 22, uses the word betroth three times to spell out Israel's triple commitment to God. And of course, Israel is the wife of the Lord. And in Hosea there, it says, I betroth you to me, or I married you to me. So Israel, the Mosaic covenant is often likened to a marriage covenant with Israel. But you know, two Jews, three opinions, right? Jews who follow the Sephardic practice wind the tefillin around the arm in an overhand clockwise direction fashion, while the Ashkenazi practices uses a counterclockwise motion. So as it is with any Jewish tradition, you're going to find another one. If you learn one, don't get dogmatic about it. Say, you know, this is Jewish tradition. Say, this is one of Jewish traditions regarding this, okay? Question.
If the Mishnah was a barrier set up to set up for the people to not be able to get directly to the law, was it also a barrier of the law to get to the people?
Well, it became that way because it became mandatory.
So the Mishnah became a barrier in both directions.
Yes.
And as a function of that, the traditions became the law, and the law became the traditions, and that was what became the area of contention.
Yes.
Between Jesus.
Exactly, exactly. And that's rabbinic rabbinic Judaism to this day.
So the, you can't look at the barrier only going in one direction.
Right.
The impediment in both directions.
Good point, because an Orthodox Jew today will start out with the basics, and that's the Torah. He'll read the Mosaic Law, but then he'll go on to the good stuff, and he'll spend the rest of his life focusing on the Talmud, the Mishnah, and the Gemara.
Okay,
and many Jewish people are biblically ignorant about the prophets, for example, Isaiah 53. Many Jewish people, Orthodox, yeshiva bokers, have never read Isaiah 53. They're just not into the Bible. They're into the Talmud. So, yes, you're right. It is a barrier both ways. Carolyn.
Bob, could you point out, I can't find where Shaddai is, the middle and
well,
the ring finger. It's
rather vague, okay?
Aren't the letters? Is that supposed to be the letters?
Yes, it's supposed to create the word Shaddai, but it's more symbolic than anything else. Okay?
Okay.
Now here is that picture of the IDF soldier praying with tefillin, and you can see the head tefillin on his head there, and the arm tefillin there. But did you happen to count the wraps around his arm? If you count them, you see it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So I don't know. Maybe he's being Ashkenazi. I don't know. Maybe his rabbi feels a little different about it. Who knows? Maybe he can't count. Anyway, so there's all about the feeling. Now remember, we looked at the Talmud, the Mishnah. The example was tefillin, and the Mishnah said that if you say there's no such thing as the tefillin and therefore violate the law of Moses, you're not liable. But because the tefillin were designated by the rabbis to have four sections in them, if you say there are five sections to tefillin, thereby contradicting the rabbis, you are guilty. And that pointed out how the Mishnah had taken precedence over the Word of God. So that was Yeshua's first response to the Pharisees and scribes was that the true character of the Mishnah is hypocrisy. Secondly, his second response was that Pharisaic tradition contradicted the law, causing one to break it or leave it, and he mentioned the practice of korban, which could be and was many times perverted in order to dishonor or not provide for mother and father. And we talked about korban a little bit there. And then Jesus said, and you do many things like these. And so we showed you the example of the Sabbath day's journey, which is one of the many, many legal fictions that the rabbis put together in order to avoid breaking the law, how to break it without breaking it, how to keep it without keeping it. And that was brought out in the MacArthur Study Bible there. All right, that brings us to his third response to this criticism that his followers don't wash their hands when they eat. And his third response, this is the middle of page 43, that the traditions often render the law null and void. Page 43, lesson 6, in the middle of the page there. And I want you to remember that he is speaking to the masses here, and he'll speak in parables. But to the disciples, he will provide exposition. He will explain what he means. So let's begin in the Mark account. The Mark account is the left-hand column, page 110, and go down to the middle of the column and verse 14. We'll read verses 14 through 16. Everybody get there? All right, verse 14. Page 110 in your harmony. And after he had called the multitude to him again, he began saying to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside the man which going into him can defile him, but the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man. If any man has ears to hear, let him hear." So there's the parable to the masses. Verse 17. And when leaving the multitude, he entered the house. His disciples questioned him about the parable. All right, so you see he goes now privately into the house in order to teach and train his disciples, and they are curious. They want to know what he means. Nobody else in the masses asked him that, but the disciples are questioning, what does he mean? But let's drop over to the slide over to the left and to the Matthew column and pick it up on verse 12. And we get a comment the disciples made before asking him about the parable. Verse 12. Everybody there in the left-hand column? Then the disciples came and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this statement?" All right, Jesus has just said that the traditions are hypocrisy, that the traditions contradict the law, causing one to break it or leave it. And he's going to say here that traditions render the law null and void. You see why the Pharisees were offended? They didn't like this because the Mishnah was their life. And it is the life of the ultra-Orthodox and the Orthodox community today. You know, you speak against the Talmud, and that's an offensive position to take. But Yeshua was not afraid of that. Let's move on to verses 13 and 14. He deals with their concern that he's being offensive. But he answered and said, "Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind, and if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit." So, his response to the disciples' concern. First of all, in regard to source, Pharisaism is a plant not planted by God. God is not the source of Pharisaism. Now, this doesn't mean that he's saying all tradition is bad. What he's speaking against is tradition made mandatory, tradition that compromises the Mosaic law. Okay? Because Jesus will follow tradition. We will see that. But he will always follow it voluntarily. He never affords tradition any authority.
So you can get from the law to the Mishnah, but not from the Mishnah to the law.
Well, you can express your obedience to the law through traditions, but you cannot make it mandatory for anyone else.
So you negate the law.
No, you don't negate the law. When you negate the law, when your tradition violates the point of the law, or when you make your tradition mandatory rather than making the law mandatory.
So okay.
The problem here is that they're making the law mandatory. Right. That's the problem that he's speaking against, not tradition as such. Okay. So he says, don't be overly concerned about offending them. And remember, guys, God is not the source of any Christian legalistic tradition either. Remember, all our churches have our traditions, how we do our services, what we do. But when we start saying that the way our church does it is the way every church ought to do it, and you're not spiritual if you don't do it our way, you have just wandered off into legalism. So traditions are okay. We have to express our faith through in the Lord some way. But we do it individually and we do it voluntarily. We don't impose our convictions on others, okay? The only thing we can hold up as authority is the Word of God. All right, so in relation to source, Pharisaic legalism did not come from God. Secondly, in relation to validity, he says they are blind guides leading blind followers. And basically, he undercuts the validity of Pharisaic Judaism. It's not valid. They are blind, not following the light of Scripture. And as far as result, they will both fall into a pit. They will experience judgment. Both the leader and the follower are responsible. Both are responsible, the leader and the follower. Nobody can say, well, the rabbis made me do it. None of us can say, well, my pastor said it was okay. None of you can say, well, Bob said it was okay.
Yeah.
All right? It's okay. We have to take personal responsibility with our walk with the Lord. Everybody in this room is responsible to study the Word for themselves, come to your conclusions, and walk with the Lord based on the Bible, not on what anyone says. All right?
So you're exonerated.
I'm exonerated, yeah. Nope. The leader and the followers are both responsible. And the pit of judgment here will be AD 70. Will be AD 70. Because that is a direct result of the unpardonable sin. Rejecting the Messiahship of Jesus resulted in the destruction of the temple and the city in AD 70. Question?
The passage that talks about those being guilty of many scribes and those being guilty of few, is that in the same context of teachers and...
Well, we do know that teachers are held more accountable. More accountable because we are supposed to know better and to be examples. So... that's not an excuse not to study the Word.
Right.
But
it seems like these guys are completely wrong, but I think maybe in some, I don't know, the many scribes and the few scribes, I think.
Well, there are degrees of punishment. There are degrees of rewards. There are degrees, okay? So that's what he's talking about there, okay? All right, let's move on then to the explanation of the parable. We're at the bottom of page 43. And we'll pick it up in the Matthew account with verse 15. So continue on down. And now we pick it up. And Peter answered and said to him, explain the parable to us. They want to know truth. And it's important that Peter is the spokesman here. It's significant. He's taking a leadership role. He's eager to learn the truth and to be illuminated by the light. Very different from the masses who quibble over Yeshua's positions. All right, verses 16 through 20. And he said, are you still lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that everything that passes, that goes into the mouth, passes into the stomach and is eliminated? But the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the man. So the issue before us is, where does defilement begin? Now, of course, the Pharisees emphasize the external act, the external emphasis. But the Mosaic law always emphasizes the internal aspect, what's going on in your heart. All right, turn to page 44. Top of the page. Continue the discussion. An example. There were dietary laws in the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law said don't eat pork. However, when you decide to eat that ham sandwich, that internal decision is the origin of sin. That's where it starts. Actions are simply the carrying out of our internal decisions. And if internal righteousness is there, external righteousness will naturally come. That'll be the fruit. That'll be the fruit. It all proceeds from inside of us out. And that's where Jesus always focuses, on the inside. That's kind of scary, you guys. I don't like him rummaging around in my private closet in there. But there's no, you know, there's no privacy restrictions on... and no privacy policies with God. Okay? He's inside that dark little closet called our heart, and he's shining his light there. And we have to learn to live with that. All right, let's move on to the Mark account. Mark covers this a little differently because he adds an explanatory comment for his Roman audience. Verse 19, bottom of page 110 in the Mark column, verse 19. Because it does not go into his heart. See, it isn't that way. What you eat doesn't go into your heart. It's what's in your heart that comes out and decides what you eat. Because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach and is eliminated. Thus he declared all foods clean. So he's making a very clear statement that will be applicable to the next dispensation. This will be true of the dispensation of grace. It is not true of the dispensation Jesus is ministering in. Jesus is ministering in the dispensation of law, and the law is fully effective at this time. But the next dispensation, the law has reached its conclusion, it's come to its goal, it's been fulfilled, and in the next dispensation we live under the law of the Messiah. We live under the new covenant. So this will be true in the next dispensation, and we'll see that in just a few minutes. Because the reason we'll see that is because Peter doesn't learn the lesson here. You know, he may be the leader, he may be looking for truth, but he's going to have to be retaught the lesson once again in Acts chapter 10. He's going to go through this in Acts chapter 10. Now, what happened in Acts chapter 10? That's the chapter dealing with the Roman Cornelius and the sheet of foods. You remember all that? All right, so we're going to just take a quick review of that incident. Peter is in Joppa at the house of Simon the Tanner, and Cornelius is informed to go to Joppa and find this man, Peter. So we pick it up in verse 9 of Acts 10. On the next day, as they, and this is the Gentile delegation from Cornelius, were on their way and approaching the city, that's the city of Jaffa or Joppa, Peter went up on the housetop, that's Simon the Tanner's house, about the sixth hour to pray. And you can visit the house of Simon the Tanner when you go to Israel. This is the current location, and this appears to be an accurate location. This house is owned by the Zakarian family and has been for years. And when Mr. Zakarian was alive, I've been in that house two times and had the opportunity to look at the archaeological evidence that this is the house of Simon the Tanner. However, in our last trip there, Mr. Zakarian had died two years earlier, and here's our guide Hila. She's there explaining the event at this location, and she knew Mrs. Zakarian personally, or she knows her, and so she went up with her secret knock to see if we could get in. And Mrs. Zakarian either wasn't our home or wasn't interested in having visitors, so we weren't able to go into the house in this particular tour. But there's Hila explaining what happened there in this location, the house of Simon the Tanner. So that is a valid location. So anyway, Peter is there, and he became hungry, and he was desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance. And he saw the sky opened up, and an object like a great sheet coming down, lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals and crawling creatures of the earth and birds of the air. In other words, kosher and unkosher food. All kinds of animals. A voice came to him. Get up, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, by no means, Lord. I have never eaten anything unholy or unclean. I've never violated the Mosaic law. Never. Again, a voice came to him a second time. What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy. This happened three times. Rise and eat. I won't, Lord. Don't consider this unholy. Rise and eat. I won't. Rise and eat. I won't. Okay? Three times it happened. Is the Lord giving him some special tutoring here? This is some special tutoring. Okay? He'd be out, yeah. But in this case, he won't be out. This happened three times, and immediately the object was taken up into the sky. Now, while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind, see, he thinks about this. He just doesn't brush it off. He starts to meditate on this. What is God trying to teach me here? As to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, the men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions for Simon's house, appeared at the gate, and calling out, they were asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. While Peter was reflecting on the vision, again, emphasis, he's meditating on this. He wants to know the truth. He wants to learn the lesson. The Spirit said to him, behold, three men are looking for you. Get up, go downstairs and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself. Why would he have misgivings? They're a bunch of Gentiles. Should I really go with them? Go with them, Peter. Okay? Now we jump down to verse 24. On the following day, he, Peter, entered Caesarea, and now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, stand up, I too am just a man. As he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled. And he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. Why do you think Peter said that? Because that's the way he'd been raised. Gentiles are dogs. They are unclean. They are unholy. Stay away from them. That's why he was going to go with misgivings if God hadn't said go. Okay? He was raised separate from the Gentiles. But notice how he gets the lesson. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. Where did he get that? He got that from the lesson of the sheet. This is a Calva Homer argument, a lesser to the greater. An argument from the lesser to the greater. Typical Jewish reasoning. Peter, if all animals are now clean for food, how much more are all people clean and objects of salvation? All right? He's preparing Peter for the fact that the gospel is going to go out worldwide. Peter, if food is considered clean now in the dispensation of grace under the new covenant, how much more are the Gentiles? Don't consider them dogs anymore. Don't consider them unclean. See the lesson he had to learn? And he got it. He finally got it. Well, I'm going to call it, okay, quick question. Well, does that mean you're supposed to eat your dog? No, I wouldn't use that. I wouldn't use that to justify your animals in heaven. All right, you guys take a break. Take a break, and we'll pick it up at the shofar. I'm going to make the break. All right, we're back underway again. All right, yeah, I know I'm big and legalistic here, yeah. Okay. All righty. So Peter has learned his lesson. And now we also see Yeshua's opinion regarding the necessity of washing hands. And that was in verse 20. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man. So he did not regard the tradition as obligatory or even as valid. Rather, he talked about the true source of defilement, the inner uncleanness, not the outer uncleanness. Now, this section is one of the major conflicts Yeshua has with the Pharisaic party. This is a major conflict because of the importance the Pharisaic party places on the tradition of hand washing. Now, from their perspective, to neglect hand washing was to be guilty of a gross carnal defilement. They had a lot to say about it, and they developed very complex rituals regarding hand washing. And on page 46, there's a summary of that. You can read that when we get through this. But the traditional writings say a number of things about hand washing. First of all, its omission would lead to temporal destruction. Sota 4b. A person who despises the washing of hands before a meal is to be excommunicated. Threaten your kids with that, huh? Whoever eats bread without first washing his hands is as though he had sinned with a harlot. That's taking hand washing pretty seriously, isn't it? And its omission would lead to poverty. They said that its omission would lead to poverty. In Maase Shabbat 62b, Rabbi Abahu said, others say in a baraita, come on you guys, a baraita is a rabbinic writing outside the Talmud. In a baraita it was taught, three things bring a man to poverty. Number one, number two, treating the washing of the hands with disrespect. They said that bread eaten with unwashed hands is the same as filth. A rabbi who held that the command to wash the hands in contempt was actually buried and outcast from the community, excommunicated. Berachot 51a, Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha said, three things were told me by Suriel, the officer of the divine presence. That's a little bit of rabbinic angelology there. Do not let water be poured over your hands by one who has not already washed his own hands. Why? Because a company of demons, according to others, a band of destroying angels, lie in wait for a man and say, when will a man do these things so that we can catch him? So in other words, if you don't wash your hands, you're open to demon possession, the rabbis taught. Yes, hang on now. It's going to correlate. Just a second here. Okay. I got to move on, you guys. Now, I want you to remember that Jesus has already been accused of what? Demon possession. All right? And so this convergence of demon possession and hand washing is important. Basically, they're making the connection that Jesus is acting like a demoniac. You see, he's demon-possessed, now he's acting like it, because he doesn't teach his disciples to wash their hands. Okay? Pretty flimsy position, but still, that's all they got. We'll see this charge come up again. This is a major issue between Jesus and the Pharisees. It will lead to his crucifixion. All right, Page 46 is an article on Netilat Yadayim, on washing of the hands. You can read that and get more of an insight into what the importance the rabbis placed on this. So now we're in section 112. Lesson 6, page 47 at the top. It's the ministry to a believing Gentile woman in Tyre and Sidon. He's now going to go north into Gentile territory. He's going to withdraw again from Galilee in order to teach his disciples. And he's got quite a lesson for them in this instance. So let's start with the Mark account. Mark chapter 7, verse 24, section 112 is on page 111 in your harmony. Section 112. The Mark account, verse 24. From there he arose and went away into the region of Tyre. And when he had entered a house, he wanted no one to know it, yet he could not escape notice. So where's he going to go? Well, here is a map of the Gospel Triangle. The three towns of Chorazin, Capernaum, and Bethsaida are often called the Gospel Triangle, And scholars estimate that 80% of Yeshua's ministry was done in that area. 80%. The vast majority of his ministry among those three towns. Now here's a Google Earth view. You see how close they are? There's the ruins of Tel Bethsaida, and there's the ruins of Capernaum, and right there are the ruins of Chorazin, right across the valley. Remember I showed you that picture where I was in Bethsaida, and I aimed my camera across the valley, and you could see Chorazin at the top of the hill. That tiny little area is where 80% of his ministry was accomplished. A tiny little area in a tiny little country on a tiny little planet in a tiny little solar system in an average-sized galaxy. Okay? Yeshua does not need, God does not need quantity. He deals in quality, doesn't he? All right, so there's the gospel triangle. He leaves that area of Galilee. He moves north into the region of Phoenicia and into the region of the city of Tyre. So he's up north out of Jewish territory at this time. All right, let's pick up the incident on the Matthew account, left-hand column, verse 22. And behold, a Canaanite woman came out from that region and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." All right, so he has this incident with this Gentile woman, and he has a conversation with her. Now, the basis of her request is his messianic character. She calls him Son of David. His messianic character has been rejected by Israel, so his answer essentially is going to be no. He doesn't perform any miracles or do anything for anybody based on his messianic character. It's been rejected. Verse 23. But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, "Send her away, for she is shouting out after us." I like this lady. She's got chutzpah, right?
Yes.
She is not deterred by Yeshua's silence. Okay? She knows that he said no, but it doesn't stop her. Again, he's not going to perform miracles on that basis, but she is persistent. And he allows it. He allows her to continue shouting after them. And that, his disciples notice it, much to their chagrin. You know, send her away. This lady's, you know, she's off her rocker. She's bothering us. Verse 24. Now he turns to her. But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Again, the answer is no. The Messiah was sent to Israel. I will not perform miracles on that basis because Israel has rejected my messiahship. Verse 25. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." Aha! That's what he's been trying to get her to do. He will perform miracles on the basis of faith in response to personal need. She's got faith, doesn't she? She's got chutzpah and faith. She shouts after him, but now she expresses her personal need. "Lord, help me." Now, to make sure she understands the situation, he responds to her in verse 26. And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the puppies." Now, in this little parable, the children are Israel. And your translation probably translates that word as dogs. Does your translation say dogs?
Yes.
Ah, that's better. Little dogs. What version is that?
New King James.
New King James. Okay. Now, the term dogs is a term in Jewish literature for Gentiles. Okay, see, that's what Peter was brought up with. Dogs are unclean. You don't eat them. Dogs are scavengers. Dogs run in packs. Dogs are dangerous. Stay away from dogs, from Gentiles, okay? That is a term, a disparaging term for Gentiles in Jewish literature. Yeshua is not being racist here. If your translation uses the term dogs, it's unfortunate because it makes it appear that he's being a racist. Here, the Greek diminutive is used. It's the word puppy, little dog, as the New King James does a little bit better job. It's a puppy, a pet. So this is not nearly so harsh a statement as the normal English translation. Okay? Puppy. It's a reminder that on the basis of his messianic character, he will not help her. The Messiah was sent to Israel. He is not to give to Gentiles what is intended for Israel. She gets it, and here's her response in verse 27. But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the puppies feed on the crumbs which fall from the master's table." Now here, her faith just explodes out like a spotlight. To paraphrase her response, "I'm not asking you to take what belongs to the Jews and gives it to the Gentiles. I'm simply asking for that which overflows from Israel. Let me receive the overflow. That's all I'm asking for." And now I can just see Yeshua's eyes light up here in joy. Verse 28, "Then Jesus answered and said to her, 'O woman, your faith is great. Be it done to you as you wish,' and her daughter was healed at once." Pretty neat. Now the answer is yes. He responds in personal need on the basis of faith. What a lesson to teach the disciples, huh? A lesson in persistent faith. A lesson in the fact, a lesson preparing them for the fact that the gospel will go out to the Gentiles. It will not be limited to Israel. And of course, that is always the message of the prophets. So he's getting them ready for the ministry they will have when he departs. All right, lesson 6, page 48 at the top. Turn to page 48. Healings in Decapolis. And again, the location is Gentile territory. Now here's our map. And the Decapolis is this purple splotch, this L-shaped purple splotch on the right-hand side. And Tyre is up here in Phoenicia. He's up in the region of Tyre. And so he leaves the area of Tyre. He skirts Galilee, goes through Syria, and he comes into Decapolis near the southeastern corner of the Sea of Galilee. So he's somewhere down in that area. Again, Gentile territory. Remember, the word Decapolis simply means 10 cities. It was 10 united cities. They were all kind of united together, and it was a mixed population, mostly Gentiles. Some Jewish people were living there. All right, let's pick it up on the Mark account. Section 113 in the middle of page 112, right-hand column. We'll pick it up on Mark 7, 31 and 32. "And again he went out from the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they entreated him to lay his hand upon him." All right, someone comes, probably a Jewish person, bringing a friend who needs healing. Now, spittle, saliva, was considered medicinal by the Jewish community. And so Jesus uses that understanding in verses 33 and 34. "And he took him aside from the multitude by himself and put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'be opened.'" Now, first of all, he takes this deaf man aside privately. The miracle here is for an individual. It's not for the masses at this point. And then he goes into some sign language. Now, he's either asking him through sign language, "Do you want me to heal you?" He's either asking him that, or he's using sign language to explain to the deaf man what he's about to do, what's going on. So he's either signing, "Do you want me to heal you?" or he's signing, "Don't panic, don't be afraid, I'm about to heal you." I would tend toward the idea that he's signing, "Do you want me to heal you?" because he does it on the basis of faith. And I would assume that the deaf man understood, shook his head, "Yeah, I understand, I want that." So we go on to verses 35 and 36. He says, "Ephatha," that is to be opened, "and his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. And he gave them orders not to tell anyone, but the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it." So he is healed, but he tells them, "Tell no one." He's keeping very low key. He's maintaining these instructions. He's there to teach his disciples more than anything else. Now, Jesus came into the Decapolis one other time, didn't he?
Yep.
What did he do there? He healed the Gerasene demoniac, right, of Legion. Okay? The Gerasene demoniac wanted to get in the boat and go with him. What did Jesus tell him to do? "Go to your people and tell them the great things God has done for you." What we see here is the result of that man's testimony. This is the fruit of the man healed from the Gerasene demoniac. Gentiles now come to listen to the Messiah. Go over to the Matthew account, verses 30 and 31. "And great multitudes came to him, bringing with them those who were lame, crippled, blind, dumb, and many others. And they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. So that the multitude marveled as they saw the dumb speaking, the crippled restored, the lame walking, the blind seeing, and they glorified" who? "The God of Israel." So now he heals many other Gentiles. Again, I would suspect one at a time, not a big mass healing the way he was doing it before. And now we see that this is a Gentile audience because they are glorifying the God of Israel. So this man's ministry is bearing fruit. The ministry of the Gerasene demoniac is bearing fruit. All right, lesson 6. We're at page 48 in the middle, section 114. The feeding of the 4,000 in the Decapolis. So again, the location. Here we are, and Jesus is located somewhere in this region, in the south, toward the southeastern corner of the Sea of Galilee. Somewhere in that area is where this occurred. Now, the incident is described in a summary statement in Matthew 15:38. So we're on page 113 of your harmony. The Matthew column, the left-hand column, the last verse. "And those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children." So this is a miraculous feeding. And Matthew notes for us that there's 4,000 men only. We know there are women and children there as well, because he mentions them, but he doesn't count them. So 4,000 men probably means the mob totaled 10 to 16,000 people. So it's not the feeding of the 4,000, it's the feeding of the 10 to 16,000, something like that. A lot more. All right, the miracle comes in verses 1 through 9 of the Mark account. So let's go over to the Mark account. I'll read the whole column, starting in verse 1. "In those days again, when there was a great multitude, and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, 'I feel compassion for the multitude, because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their home, they will faint on the way, and some of them will have come a distance.' And his disciples answered him, 'Where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in a desolate place?' And he was asking them, 'How many loaves do you have?' And they said, 7. And he directed the multitude to sit down on the ground, and taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to his disciples to serve them, and they served them to the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and after he had blessed them, he ordered these to be served as well. And they ate and were satisfied. and they picked up 7 large baskets full from what was left over of the broken pieces. And about 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. Again, he goes through this conversation with the disciples to teach them the lesson, because we learned earlier they had not learned the lesson of the feeding of the 5,000, right? They hadn't learned it, so here it comes again. And God will do it to us, too. Peter didn't get it. He got the lesson a second time. The disciples didn't get it. They get the lesson a second time. We don't get it. It'll come again. It'll come again, you guys. Don't doubt it. All right? And the lesson, basically, is depend on me. Distribute what I provide. It's the same lesson he taught previously in the feeding of the 5,000. But he now has an additional lesson to add to it. The additional lesson, Gentiles will also benefit from the Messiah's coming. Again, he's preparing them for the greater ministry that they will have when he departs. Now, this is the second miraculous feeding. There are 2 miraculous feedings in the Gospels. And the morning class wanted this chart, so you will get it. Well, you will get it. All right. In regard to number, the first feeding had 5,000 men plus women and children. The second feeding, 4,000 men plus women and children. So the numbers are different. In regard to location, the first feeding was near Bethsaida. The second feeding is in the Decapolis. The locations are different. As regard to time, the feeding of the 5,000 took place over approximately 1 day. The feeding of the 4,000 takes place over 3 days. In regard to leftovers, the leftovers are different. With the 5,000, there were 12 baskets. With the 4,000, 7 baskets. In regard to Yeshua, Matthew will state in Matthew 16:9, he'll refer to the 5,000, and in Matthew 16:10, he will refer to the 4,000. Now, why did I, and there are many other differences between these two feedings. Now, why do I bring this up? Why did I write this chart? I did this because critics of the New Testament often state that these two events are the same event. And then they go on and say that the writers were confused and contradictory. It's a way to try and undermine the New Testament. But these are very clearly 2 separate events. There's no contradiction, there's no confusion on the part of the gospel writers. None at all. So just note that in case you run into that crazy objection to the gospels. All right, page 49, lesson 6, section 115. We return to Galilee and we run into the Pharisees and Sadducees once again. Here we'll see him rejected in Magadan. So let's start with the Matthew account. That's the bottom of page 113. And we're in the left-hand column, verse 39, bottom of the page. And sending away the multitudes, he got into the boat and came to the region of Magadan. Now it's important to note that this is Jewish territory. Now here's our map. So Jesus and the disciples probably walked over to the Sea of Galilee, and they probably hired a boat in the harbor of Gadara. That was a major harbor in the area. We've seen that before. Maybe they went to the harbor of Susita. Who knows? But there were plenty of opportunities to hire a small boat. And they get in the boat, and they cross the Sea of Galilee over to the western side to the region of Magadan or Magdala. And if you look at the Mark account, Mark chapter 8, verse 10, he says, and immediately he entered the boat with his disciples, and they came to the region of Dalmanutha. Dalmanutha. Now, is this a contradictory situation in the Gospels? Is it Magadan or Dalmanutha? Well, the so-called contradiction is easily resolved because there are 4 names for this city. It's called Magdala. That's where Mary Magdalene came from, Mary of Magdala. It's called Magadan. It's called Dalmanutha. It's called Tarike. All right, so it's four names for this area. There is no contradiction here. Okay? So don't be intimidated by that little criticism either. It's on your, yeah, it's on the top of your notes there. Okay. All right, now let's start with Matthew 16, verse 1. We have to turn the page to page 114. And at the top of the page, the left-hand column is the Matthew account, verse 1. Here's the incident. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came up and testing him and asked him to show them a sign from heaven. So it's just as soon as he gets into Jewish territory, what happens? Bang! Pharisees are right there. They wouldn't go into unclean Gentile territory. But as soon as he gets back, they're right there. And they want another sign from heaven. But what is their conclusion when he gives them signs? It's from hell. It's a sign from hell. That's their conclusion. So Jesus will give no more signs but one. So here's his response to their request, verses 2 and 3. He answered and said to them, "When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And the morning, there will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening. Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but cannot discern the signs of the times?" The point of his statement is that sufficient signs and evidence have already been given. See, this is not a weather report, you guys. He's not warning them, don't go out on the Sea of Galilee. Sufficient evidence has already been given. Verse 4. "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given it except the sign of Jonah. And he left them and went away." So again, for the nation, no more signs but one, the sign of the prophet Jonah, the sign of resurrection. On this, let's remember all the way back to the beginning of his ministry, John 2, 18 through 22. "Then the Jews said to him, 'What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?' Jesus answered them," remember these things were the cleansing of the temple. "Jesus answered them, 'Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.' The Jews then said, 'It took 46 years to build this temple, and you'll raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken." So again, Jesus knows what his mission is. He knows he's going to die. He knows he's going to be resurrected. And he knows the importance of that, not only for our salvation, but as a witness to Israel. That's the sign that they will get. So he's anticipating what was to come. All right, let's go to page 50 at the top, and we come to an application. We come to the end of lesson number 6. And so let's close our lesson with some thoughts of application. I should be able to get you out of here right on time. Nah. All right. The theme I chose for this second half of lesson 6 was the Messiah's Lordship. And as we looked at the biblical material, here's the thoughts that came to me. During this lesson, he kept driving home the point that to call him Lord means that we must live our lives his way, not our way. Four examples, positive and negative. First of all, the disciples thought that feeding the 5,000 and feeding the 4,000 was impossible until they did it his way. They submitted to his way and they were blessed. They were able to do the impossible. They saw between 15 to 20,000, between 10 to 16,000 people fed. They were blessed because they did it his way. Secondly, speaking primarily of the feeding of the 5,000, the Galilean masses learned that he would not be king on their terms. Remember, they tried to force him to be king. They had to accept him his way. They rejected that. They lost out. Bread of Life discourse. Thirdly, the Pharisees again got the message that he would not live his life their way in submission to the Mishnah, but he demanded of them that they live their life his way. And they rejected that and lost out. And finally, the Syrophoenician woman. I love this lady. I'm going to give her a big hug when I get to the kingdom. I tell you, she had chutzpah, she had guts. She didn't stop. The Syrophoenician woman learned that he was Lord. She submitted. Lord, help me. And she was blessed. She refused to take no for an answer. She submitted to the way he wanted to do it. Well, not necessarily. Bowing was not necessarily worship. All right, personal application. Here's where it starts to hurt. Are we struggling against the Messiah's lordship in our life, or are we submitting and being blessed? And there's what it gets down to, guys. We are either struggling or submitting. One of the two. That's where everybody in this room is today, whether you admit it or not. You're either struggling or submitting. I am. So maybe you could write down the area of struggle, or the era. Area. There we go. It's an era, too. The area of submission you're experiencing today. And think of the whole person, body, soul, and spirit. And remember, God's looking in that dark little corner of your heart. He's looking in that little closet that you have the lock on. Nobody but you knows about. Nobody but you and him. I know that because I'm in the same boat. He's in there rummaging around inside of my spirit and soul as well. All right, plan of action. Try to put this in practical terms. How could you practically respond to this area of struggle? How could you practically respond? Well, I have 8:31. I lied. I did not let you out on time. I knew that would happen. All right, so let's pray, and I'll turn you loose, and we'll see you here next week, July. That's my fourth mistake. I'm tired. It's late. I'm tired. I know you guys are late. July 3rd. July 3rd, we will meet for Bible study. You guys voted on it, so we will be meeting. Okay, let's pray. Father, again, we want to bring before you ourselves, our struggle with submission or with obedience, with our struggle or our submission that comes from your word. Help us to learn the lessons you want us to learn. Sometimes those struggles are because we don't understand, like Peter. Sometimes they come after searching and meditating. We get understanding. So Lord, help us with our struggles to learn what you want us to learn, and then help us to submit to it the way Peter did. He was able to go with those Gentiles without misgivings. He was taught to see that Gentiles are eligible to be saved. Help us to learn the lessons you have for us. We may not have the lessons Peter had to learn. We may not have to learn the lessons the disciples had to learn that you provide, and we're to simply distribute what you provide. But we have to learn something in our lives, Lord. So help us. We need your help. We're like that Syrophoenician woman. Lord, help me. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.